But just before we get started, I would like to say a big thank you to Naylor Agility for sponsoring this podcast. They are a UK equipment provider for agility equipment. They specifically produce tunnels, tunnel bags, agility jumps and stacking blocks, as well as wobble boards. So Naylor Agility have been a huge support in me starting this podcast, and they provide fantastic high quality equipment. I cannot recommend them enough. So thank you, Naylor, again for supporting the Agility Rose Talk and Train podcast. And without further ado, let's get into the episode. So hi, Neil. Thank you for joining me on the podcast today. I really appreciate your time. And we've got a very exciting topic to discuss, which I've asked for questions on Instagram. So we're going to be discussing course design today, which I'm very excited to be asking questions around and learning from as well, coming off the back of the Love the Lines workshops. So they were really fun. So just to get started then, would you like to introduce yourself, your dogs, how long you've been in agility for, and your favourite achievement to date?
Yeah, hello. Thanks for having me. It's always nice to have these like facilitated chats about specific topics, and course design is a very hot topic at the moment, or particularly over the last sort of 12 months. So my name's Neil Ellis. I'm 29. I currently live with my wife and our three dogs. We have three border collies. I have one and my wife has two. And my favorite or best achievement to date, wow. I think it has to be my seventh place finish in one of the rounds of the European Championships back in 2012 or 2011, can't remember what year, with my Springer Spaniel Chester. Would have to be my competing highlight, I think.
And do you have one for Pigeon as well?
I've done a couple of big finals. I think the highlight for me is called BAC. So yeah. It's the Bavarian Agility Challenge Kruth. It's an event in Germany that happens every other year, and they asked me to judge the final on a Saturday evening. So you have quite literally 100 finalists. They dim all the other lights in this massive indoor sand arena. And you have people sort of breathing down your neck, looking just over at some tiered seating. That gave me a real buzz for like what it was like hour and a half. That was quite a memorable final to judge.
That must have been incredible and quite high pressure as well, I imagine.
It was particularly, I hadn't been judging internationally for that long then. So I was quite surprised to be offered that final. And then, it was also a bit strange as well, because the rings, although they were 20 by 40 or a little bit more than that, the entry and exit side was on the longer side.
Oh.
So whereas typically you see it on the shorter side. So it made the course design element quite challenging, but quite interesting. I think it went well. So yeah, definitely a final that I will remember judging for a long time.
Fantastic. Super. So if you're ready, we'll get into the first question. So we've got a couple, I think we've got 10 in total. The first one is, how do you go about designing a course, and what is the process like, for example, going from a blank canvas to creating the finished design?
Well, I have a bit of a love-hate relationship with course design. So it is now my life. I am course designing literally every single day, whether that's for a training day, or whether that's for a jump competition I'm judging, or whether that's for a course design request I've got from somebody. So a bit where people have like writer's block, I often get like course design block. So I think sometimes I exhaust all possibilities and feel like I'm banging my head against my computer screen sometimes with how difficult I find it sometimes. So yeah, sometimes I can get courses out really like within 5-10 minutes. Literally, I just get a bit of inspiration, and other times it does take a while. But for me, I always like to start with I don't with a blank piece of paper. So my white screen, I use Smarter Agility Course Designer, and I like to start with a blank screen. Now, that doesn't mean to say that I won't think about or consider a sequence that I've actually, and sometimes it is from what I've seen other judges do. Yeah, so particularly my international judging colleagues, there's a lot of sequences that are common, but they're seen in different setups.
Mm-hmm.
So what I mean by that is it could be like there's a tunnel under a dog walk combination with the weaves, or a couple of jumps, or like a different layering exercise, and you wanna you wanna replicate that, or at least do a similar sort of setup. And it never is the same, because obviously you have your own course design sort of style that takes over with how the setup looks and how it manifests itself. And I think also it depends on the amount of space you've got as well. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't really, I look at a lot of course designs from other judges, for sure. It's like I'm obsessed with them, but for sure. I like to start with a blank piece of paper. And yeah, if I have like a sequence in my head or a thought that I've had during the day, or that I've done with a training exercise that I want to put into a competition, then I'll try and start with that. But sometimes I just start with number one and I just see where it takes me, really.
Mm-hmm.
I do find numbers 1 to 3 generally the hardest.
Yeah.
Because for me, that dictates a lot of where the course, or how the rest of the course ends up mm-hmm. for me. So I like to play around with the starts and have different variations. I just let my imagination run wild.
Amazing. And I'd say it's quite difficult, isn't it? That first few steps in getting into the course design is the hardest one, because once you've sort of got a little bit of a path and ideas start running through your head, I imagine it's much quicker, but it's just starting the process that is probably the most difficult point.
Exactly. I think that's right. I think, yeah, for me personally as well, once you've got the first one sort of 4 or 5 obstacles, or you've thrown in the dog walk or a couple of tunnels or something, and you know, you're almost limited a little bit as to, for me anyway, where you can go next. As I said, it sort of dictates where the rest of the course might go.
Yeah.
And that can be quite frustrating, because I've seen so many courses I've used, I could have used in different scenarios and different setups. But the problem is I don't like using the same course twice.
Oh, interesting.
So I will never go back to a course I've already done. Never. Particularly for judging, so I will always start with a blank sheet of paper. So I almost feel like I've missed the opportunity to use it, and unfortunately, I have a very poor memory, and I have so many things going on that I often forget what I wanted, the sort of the intention behind a certain sequence. Like when I come back to it, another course design. So I sometimes try and force a sequence or something to happen, but it doesn't help for a number of, it doesn't work for another reasons, like judging position or like distances on the course. It just doesn't add up.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore I have to settle for maybe second best. I'm obsessed with course design, but sometimes it can be a little bit frustrating.
Yeah, I can imagine. And like I say, when you're doing it every day, it must be like you described it, writer's block sometimes, because they've got so much to think about and put out there. But that's really good answer to that. Thank you. So question two, if you're happy to move on. What would you say is the easiest mistake to make when designing courses? And if possible, how can they be resolved or fixed?
So it's a very good question. Whoever has that on Instagram. I think it's really easy to forget that there's often more space than you think you have on a course.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is, I think typically what we see on course design in the UK is there's can often be a focus on one area of the course, or one area of the ring. So if someone wants to put a specific skill or discrimination, often you see that there's a lot of focus in one area of the course. It's like a heat map.
Yeah.
And if you were to put a heat map where people were running, some areas would be really blue and others would be super hot red.
Yeah.
So I do the same. So I can obsess about one area of the course or one section of the course. And then all of a sudden I remember that I have another vast amount of space on the course that I'm not using.
Mm-hmm.
So the easiest mistake is to actually forget to use all the space. And focusing too much on one specific area of the course. And that's why I do like what I call a sense check. So yeah. I am aware that sometimes I can obsess about a certain skill set or like sequence. And so I will typically sometimes, even if I go and make a cup of tea, or if I, you know, even it's something just to have a break to go to the loo or let the dogs out or do another job sometimes. It doesn't even need to be that long a job. It's just something different. It gives my head chance to reset a bit, and also I come back a bit more fresh.
Yeah.
And I can go, okay, actually, let's look at the bigger picture here. So sometimes that happens really quickly, and I don't, you know, it doesn't necessarily come after a break or something, but other times I need a little bit longer to figure it out. But yeah, I think in order to resolve that is remember that there's multiple skill sets you can test.
Mm-hmm.
I think still today, I think maybe it can't come up in a bit different question, but is encouraging people to use as much of the space as possible. So
yeah.
Don't forget that you have more space on the course than I think people see. And I think the courses that people send me for feedback, I'm always trying to encourage them to push out. I think they forget that they've got all this space and therefore the distances can be a little bit more reasonable for dogs of all levels.
Mm-hmm.
And I just find that it creates a more balanced course design if you use all the space and you're not focused solely on one area of the course. I think that sort of goes hand in hand with my next point,
yeah.
Which is that it's easy to use multiple jumps too quickly. So, for example, using jump number four as number four and number eight,
mm-hmm.
Or only after four or five different obstacles. So typically I encourage myself to not use a jump twice. And I think it's something I am getting better at. But definitely as a rule of thumb, I wouldn't do anything below sort of seven obstacles.
Yeah.
Because that then naturally sort of falls into point number one, where you almost force yourself to look at using other areas of the course that you hadn't already or may not have already used.
Amazing. Yeah, and I think that's a really good point, actually, about not using the same jump all the time or so quickly, because I always like the phrase less is more, because I think sometimes I've seen it in a few courses actually recently. Absolutely. Where they've took less jump, well, they've took more jumps out, and maybe there's four or five jumps in there with the agility equipment, but actually it gives much better flowing course design because you've got a lot more space to work with then.
So true. It's so true, and it's a really good point. I think I've just actually saw a course plan online yesterday, I think. I mean, there's probably more over the weekend coming from the weekend, but definitely one that I remember had like six jumps in it for an agility course in a 35 by 35 ring, you know, what we get in the UK. So definitely less is more. And you, particularly for agility classes,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. Especially when you're trying to fit in a dog walker seesaw on an A-frame.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's dog. Crazy, isn't it? It's
very crazy. Amazing. Yeah. So, next question. Do you have any advice when it comes to nesting courses to suit several class grades? So, for example, Judge has got 1-3 and 6-7 without being able to move large pieces of equipment. It might be an indoor. I imagine this scenario may be in tight for time.
Yeah, and this is a bugbear of mine, really, because I think judges, there's so much more pressure, or there's so much pressure on judges, because shows typically like to offer more runs, so mm-hmm. it's very common now to see like four runs a day per height and grade. So you know, you can easily see over 10 classes per ring.
Yeah.
And you're right as well. I think the other problem is that if you were to, let's give that example of going from grades 1-3 to 6-7, that's quite an unfair transition, really,
yeah.
Because for me that's a huge changing in course design, and it's something that particularly internationally you don't see. Either there's another judge, what I mean by that is you can often see like A3 to A2, A2 to A1. So it'd be like grade 6 to 7, grade 3 to 5, grade 1 to 3. So it's an easier step down. And therefore the change is generally a little bit less drastic each time. So yeah, this is a bugbear of mine because it it's really, really hard. and what I also hear and see as well is that people are encouraged to not move anything because there's time pressures. And quite honestly, the one thing I tell people is that you take as much time as you need to change what you need to in order to be happy and confident with what you've designed, and that it's safe. So it's not unusual for me to go a bit later on a judging day if it means I've had to move a tunnel and repeg a tunnel. If it means I have to do it myself, then so be it. but definitely less is more if you're doing these sorts of things. So I think be really tactful, be really mindful. So I sometimes play around with whether I start with, if for example I have to go from 1 to 3 to 6 to 7, I often, most of the time, I'll start with the higher graded class and then work back.
Yeah.
Maybe because I enjoy designing for 6 7s more. I find it easier probably. it's definitely more complex in terms of the course design. But then I have found that it's harder for the 1 to 3. So I've also tried to do it the other way and done 1 to 3 first. So what I would suggest is definitely less is more. So give yourself flexibility to move jumps, definitely. Yep. I think if you are put in this situation, and for example, you've got a tunnel to dog walk situation for 1 to 3s, then keep, you know, it's, there's enough other things you can test other than, you know, the tunnel dog walk combination. So think about testing the exit of the dog walk if you've got a tunnel to start, so flipping the course round. So maybe you test a backside or a threadle or, you know, something harder on the exit, but keep the straight line tunnel onto the dog walk, then, you know, you've got your guaranteed safe line. I would absolutely be happily moving seesaws and A-frames if I need to, but just be mindful that not only it might be changing, it might change in terms of the heights you're judging, and therefore there's no way that I would keep courses the same for all four heights, in that I might need to tweak a couple of angles of jumps and things. And that I think that goes hand in hand with all the type of dog you're going to get, 1 to 3, between 1 to 3 and 6 to 7. So as you become more minimalistic with your course design in 1 to 3s, where there's less obstacles, and typically the courses are faster because there's less technicality to them, dogs are going to travel and move on different trajectories and different lines. So it's really good just to take some time to definitely move angles of jumps, move tunnels if you need to, really. Honestly, I can't encourage that anymore. Just be happy with what you're setting, and take an extra 2 or 3 minutes with no one walking the course to make sure you're happy and satisfied with what you've set.
Fantastic. I mean, like I say, I like your point, obviously, of if you need to take any longer to just get the course how you want it to be. There's no shame in obviously taking that little bit extra. I think everyone tries to finish first in terms of when I ring partied and everyone likes to push to be the first one.
And I think there's like, it's twofold. It comes from one, from the show organisers that put pressure on, you know, I want you to judge 10 classes and you need to get done by the end of the day. But then also I can't help but notice that judges go, well, you know, I want to get the day done. It's like, well, you've offered to judge for the day.
Yeah.
What else are you going to do?
That's it.
Do you know what I mean? I think if you're willing to give the time up to judge, just because you want to, what's the point? You've been there for 7.5 hours. What's the difference? Another half an hour, which just includes those two or three minutes before each course walk. And it gives you that chance to sense check either on your own or with someone you trust. And where you're in a situation or an environment where you're not feeling pressured. And if you are feeling pressured, either by competitors can, you know, you can just ignore them, but if it's the show organizers, then it's worth saying something, because that's not fair on you as a judge. Definitely very hard, but take that time to be be sure you're happy with what you've set.
Yeah, 100%. I think that's a really good message. Brilliant. So question four, are there any elements of safe course design which seem to be more overlooked or forgotten than the likes of maybe contact entries and exits and safe lines? So this is kind of, I think the question's basically aiming at, is there anything that is lesser argued in terms of course design safety, but is just as important?
Yeah, I think, I mean, they're the big ones, really, aren't they? Contact yeah. entries and exits and safe lines. So they're the ones that we really, really like obsess about. But I think for me, I think it's safety for the handler.
Yeah.
So I think often it's not really something we concern ourselves with that much or feel we need to, but there is often situations where you see, I like to call them forced lead leg changes. So dogs are, whether this does fall into safe lines a little bit, but whether the dog's line is not as natural and therefore the handler is having to encourage the dog onto the correct lead leg. So it's a forced lead leg change. And when you have a forced lead leg change, often there's a, what I call like a collision point. Yes. So there's a point in which the handler could well just collide with a dog. And, you know, if you've got a lower graded competition and you have that or lower graded class and you do that, then you know, you are at risk of a dog and handler injury. So, yeah, I think maybe handler restrictions, I think it probably covers within that. And handler restrictions doesn't just mean like the layering of obstacles, but you can also sort of cover within that mobility. So like the restrictions on actually, is it feasible, even for a large, reasonably fast handler like myself, actually, what risk are you putting by encouraging this false lead leg change? And is there a risk to handler and dog welfare by setting that up? I think that would have to be the one that came to my head, because you know, safe lines and entry and exits onto contacts, I think really are the big ones.
Yeah, definitely. And do you know what, it was actually something I didn't even think about now you've mentioned it, with the forced lead leg changes and the collision zone. It's something that I guess people kind of take into consideration and think, oh well, the handlers will negotiate how they must, but actually as a judge you need to set something that's going to be safe and suitable for all handlers, isn't it? So that's really good.
Exactly. Yeah I think with safe lines, i.e. less forced lead leg changes, where the handler is having to do as much work with that really, and where you set a course that is just focusing on skill sets and you know, trying to get just aiming for to test those specific skill sets on the safe lines. I think it's not something you really have to worry about, but it's when you have these forced lead leg changes, these awkward turns, particularly turns out of tunnels really. And similar setups that when handlers are trying to move fast to support the most ideal line is when you may run into difficulties.
Definitely. And I think one thing I've learned from my own trainer is to try and design more for the person that's going to be running a big Malinois than your average maybe small handler, because the Malinois is more likely more damage than it is a small little terrier.
I really like it. Yeah. And it's actually something that there's a whole competition called the FMBB. I don't know what it stands for, but it's literally for Malinois. And it's international competition. And one of the things they like to think about is, or at least the course design is tailored so that you don't have many like really fast slice obstacles, because Malinois not only are they reckless and super crazy, but they also are they also don't bend that well.
So
you have to consider, you know, that actually it's not just the dogs but the handlers in these situations as well, is what risks that could pose to them.
100%, because I would not like to be on the receiving end of that.
Oh my word, I cannot imagine.
Super. So question five, do you have any advice for designing courses in small spaces?
Use every single inch of that space you have.
I was gonna say
literally. Yeah, it's quite common. So today I've designed a course in a 13 meter wide by 30, so quite skinny. Luckily they had lots of tunnels, but one thing I would definitely encourage is In order to like combine the space, I wouldn't put the tunnel on one end. We see commonly, we see like a tunnel either the longest bit at the bottom or longest bit at the top, to get it out of the way, so to speak. But actually, I would encourage you to drop it down a bit, 3 or 4 meters in, and put some tunnels underneath them, because it allows you to create really a multiple number of variations of course design and sequences whilst connecting all areas of the ring together. So definitely use every single ounce of space. Use less jumps. And this applies to KC shows as well. I think I know you could say, well, you know, Neil, you just said that we should try and use as little as possible, like jumps, like one after another, or like lots of jumps in one space. But if it means you keep that minimalistic sort of view and picture in your head, it just means you've got loads more flexibility with the space and able to open up different spaces. So definitely dog walk, not at the top of the ring. Put some tunnels underneath it. Use all the space, but also use tunnels as good connectors on the edges as well. So I put weaves along the edge. I'm just looking at one of the courses actually that I did yesterday, and put tunnels right across on the edge of the ring, and I literally look for any wasted space.
Yeah,
I'm like, okay, have I wasted any space here? Now, do you know what? Can I add a different sequence in there? Yes, I can actually. So yeah, let your imagination run wild a bit. Don't be limited because you've got a short space. There's so many hundreds of different sequences you can use with 7 or 8 jumps and a couple of tunnels and a dog walk. So fill it.
Definitely.
Use every square inch. It doesn't mean with jumps.
Yeah.
Like a square inch jump everywhere. But yeah, make sure that there are some dog's lines and skills placed in every corner.
Every square, definitely.
Every that's
a really good message, because as you say, I think that's one of the best elements, I think, about course design, is that the opportunities are endless. And
They really are.
Brilliant.
Absolutely.
Super. So question 6, I think we touched on it a little bit in a previous question for the answers, but do you think smalls and mediums should begin to run over different courses to intermediate and large dogs in competition? And if so, could you see this rolling out more into competitions?
100% they should. 100%. Yeah, I think obviously, so to use Iconics, for those that might not know, Iconics is my line of dog agility shows. I have to shout out Jen Slade, who's my show secretary, but she's also an absolute guru in, like, she's a genius in sorting out ring layouts and class structure and planning the rings. And one of the reasons why it takes Jen so long, I say so long, she'll be offended by that, but like a couple of days to really to do it, is because we are so mindful that even if we try and avoid clashes, we never put an intermediate with a medium or a small with a large, or a small with an intermediate or large. If we're splitting the classes, we split them smaller, medium and intermediate, large. Because we are aware that typically you will have some super fast medium dogs, but typically intermediate and large move very differently to smaller mediums. Probably the closest link is obviously medium and intermediate, but typically a lot of large dogs have come down to 50 and therefore they still would typically move and their trajectory remains quite the same. So yes, definitely think we should be seeing smaller mediums run over different courses to intermediate and large. What I mean, and that obviously changes, for example, so we split, we could have like 6, 7 small medium and then large and intermediate 4, 5. So the courses might change. I think, Will it roll out? In a word, because I think there's so much pressure, time pressure on judges anyway, that I think whilst this is an ideal situation, I can't see it happening religiously, we can't expect it to be seen more commonly. So I think we go back to that advice really at the top in question 3, which is, if I am going from small to medium to intermediate to large, I would always design for the large dogs.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because then you are, you know, and I think people go, oh, what, it's not really fair on the small dogs, because then, you know, the skills are maybe not as hard because it's the bigger distances. It's like, well, the distance in itself is a hard skill. And also, I've never seen a small medium course that's set for six, like the same skill sets for that course, just because things are a bit more stretched out. I haven't seen it be ran any easier.
Yeah.
I think the skills are still there. You still have to get it right. So, yeah, in an ideal world, yes, we would see this, but I don't feel we would. And so, yeah, just be mindful. I think this goes out to sort of show organisers as well, really, is just maybe consider that you can split your grades into different rings. You don't need to have large, medium, intermediate, small, all like one after another in the same ring of the same grade. Mm. And so if you are splitting it, but split it definitely small, medium, and then intermediate and large.
Yeah, and it's interesting actually, because I've accepted a couple of appointments this year, and a few of them I've got is where maybe my 1 to 3s are all the same grades. However, I think I've got 4 to 5 jumping, and I've only got large and intermediate for that, and the same for another agility class somewhere else. I've only got 6, 7 large and intermediate agility, which I think is going to make course designing so much simpler.
That's really good. That is super good, and it's really nice to hear that is happening. Because that is that, you know, whether it's down to luck, but hopefully not, there is some thought that's some thought that's gone behind that, which is super good.
Yes, fingers crossed. Like I say, hopefully show managers are listening and can start to get the ball rolling with that idea.
I think absolutely. It'd be
brilliant. And even like I say, even having the concept of having less classes in a day, it gives you that allowance to have maybe a little bit more of flexibility in what you're setting. You've only got... Sorry, you go ahead.
No, sorry. Definitely. I mean, we're not on a show managers podcast, but to touch on that, it's... You know, if I needed a seventh ring because the entries were super big, then I would have an extra ring. But unfortunately, what we have is maybe they're not considering it so much, but we have a lot of shows now that are trying to run 4-ring shows, regardless of the entries they've got.
Yeah.
So they have, and if you think about it, right? So I host, we have 3 runs a day for 4 heights, so for 4 grades. So we have 36 classes per day, and it works out really well that you have 6 classes per ring, so you know your 6 classes over 6 rings is 36. And we've done that deliberately because we're knowing that to be fair, one year we had for the by night show, I think we had like 10 one ring one show we had like four rings, and what I really really didn't like it because we had 10 classes per ring. It just didn't sit well with me. So, but you know, we have people, maybe some show organisers with venues that aren't suitable for larger shows trying to run larger shows.
Yeah.
And then these poor judges have got, you know, 10 judges and 10 classes with 4 course changes. And I think it's good to be mindful about, you know, is it reasonable to ask what you are of your judges, given the number of entries you are anticipating and the venue you have.
Definitely. And like I say, a lot of it comes down to the amount of runs that have been given out, and also the amount of classes that you've just got in a day. It like I say, it's impossible to, when you've got 10 classes in a day and you're already up against it in terms of timing, those extra course design elements just make it even more complex and longer. Brilliant. Super. So question 7, I think you'll like this one. How do you determine what skills suit which grades, and how difficult to make a course in general? Or do factors like the show location, qualifiers available, and prestige influence you to design any differently?
So, this is very interesting, because again, I think this, what's the word? We might have to cut this bit out. But
it's all right.
What's it called? It's like a myth buster.
Yes.
So like common
misconceptions, is it?
That's the one. Yeah. It's like, okay, so because I'm going to a show in Devon, that's gonna change what I set because it's in Devon compared to if I'm going to the middle of the country. And that's no disrespect to Devon. Well, this is my point, or to even to Scotland or somewhere else from more remote. the show location doesn't make any difference to me.
Yeah.
If I'm setting a 6-7 in the southeast, I'm setting a 6-7 the same course in the southwest.
Yeah.
The rule book doesn't specify that based on location, your course design changes. So the standards for me for each grade don't change just because I'm going to a different part of the country. I think that's the first sort of the most important point for me. So in terms of what course I set in general, I would happily set the same wherever I'm going. Now, qualifiers are slightly different because I try and set a course relevant to that qualifier. So if it's across singles, it's going to be a little bit more technical.
Yeah.
If it's going to be an Olympia course, it's going to be a little more fast and a bit easier anyway. And if it's champ, then it's going to be hard.
Yeah.
for sure, which I think, again, we don't see enough of. So I don't really feel like, before we go on to the skills, I don't really feel like I think it's pretty clear cut for me. You know, if you're going, wherever you're going, it's that grade is that grade.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing as well, just a side note on that, is that we hear people, judges talking about sort of, I'm a bit leaner on my refusals for a grade one dog to a grade seven dog.
Mm.
It's like, well, that doesn't benefit that grade one dog at all, does it?
No.
Because if you're being easier on a grade one dog, you're basically giving them permission to be less smooth and clean, like clinical on their run, and they're able to progress up the grades, maybe naively thinking that, you know, they can handle their dog like that and not get refusals. Just a little side note on that, but so from that point of view, it's very easy for me. So the skills and grades, I've been quite influenced by what they do abroad with this now, not because of the course design in general, but the way things are set up. So in abroad, they have three levels in most countries. Some countries have a fourth level, A0, but typically it's level one, level two and level three. So level one is for just dogs coming out in competition, maybe just beginning like to fully sequence obstacles. And therefore there's really nothing technical about it. The obstacles you want the dogs to see are in front of them. But it doesn't mean that they're not going to see like soft backside. So what we mean by that is that the line for the dog is very obvious to the backside of that jump.
Yeah.
So the other important point to know about this is those courses are only maybe 15 or 16 obstacles long.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do they consider what skills they're testing, but they also consider actually how long they expect their dog to perform for, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And in A2, you sort of see like 19 or 20 obstacles, and in A3, that's when you see your 22 obstacles. So for me, that's a very clear progression pathway in terms of performance, without the skills involved. So to bring that back to the UK, so I'm more mindful now about setting, you know, 15 obstacles, 16 obstacles for grades one to two, and then into novice, maybe 18 obstacles.
Yeah.
And then for you know, your grade 6, 7, 20. And I actually really underestimated that, the impact of that on the dogs, and actually the what that in itself creates is to, or contributes to, the difficulty of the course. So that's one area which I'm more mindful of now. One other thing I'm mindful of now, less for A1 now because we've just spoken about that, but for grades 3-5, sort of your novice grades and your grades 6-7, your advanced, you know, you have your skills like your wrong end of tunnels, your backside, your threadle wraps, your general threadles. Then you have your skills off the dog walks. You maybe even consider your seesaw independence and all those things. And for me, that I sort of look at it, particularly with jump skills, I look at it in a few different ways. So the approach to the jump, so how acute is the angle of the threadle, or how acute is the angle of the backside? Even what obstacle is it coming off? So for me, backsides are harder off sort of dog walks and out of tunnels than they are off of other jumps, normally, just because the dogs are moving and behaving differently. So that's the first thing, is actually the angle of approach. And then we're looking at the speed of approach. So what line have they happened, or what's happened before? So is it a really fast line? Is it actually a collection just before that skill? Because that contributes to actually how hard the skill is for the dog.
Yeah.
And the third thing is the handler movement. So what is the handler having to do? Is the handler having to sprint away? Can it support the dog? Are they layering something? Is there a handler restriction so they have to layer it? And that for me, without sort of, you know, listing all the skills, they're the three sort of key points I'm considering when I'm thinking about whether a skill or a sequence within a course is hard.
Interesting. I think that's a really, really good point there. And I must admit, going back to the number of obstacles in the course, I think that's a really good thing to bring to the podcast and to share, because as you say, the concentration levels of a young dog is going to be far different to what we expect on our
it's so true, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, these are dogs
I really underestimated it, and now I look back and think, wow, like even I would set a 20 jump course for a grade 1 to 2, and I'm like, that is so unfair.
Yeah, it is.
Like, these dogs are barely sequencing that in training. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's not that they're not ready for competition, but you know, that partnership is building.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's quite common as well for judges to, or even for competitors to maybe comment on, you know, you get to a course and it's 16 obstacles and think you've not got your money's worth. I know I've heard that from others before, but I think that's a really good point to share for people that maybe haven't been in agility for so long and are interested in the course design concepts, is that for a young dog, we're asking a lot of them to do.
Definitely.
Brilliant. No, that's giving me some food for thought there as well. I think we're going back to my designs.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Also, and that does help, you know, because we always talk about how it's really hard to design for grades 1 to 3.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you've got an agility course, once you get your 12 weaves, your three obstacles, your three contact obstacles, and a couple of tunnels, you're already halfway there anyway.
Yeah.
And at that level, that's what I'm expecting in terms of performance from that dog, really.
And you just need the jumps to connect you between all the other tunnels to connect.
Exactly. Now, I want a little bit more, you know, I think you can still make horses fun, funner than just going up and down know, up and down, up and down. I think, you know, that's often seen quite a lot. But yeah, within the principle is, you can definitely reduce the number of obstacles you have.
Fantastic. Amazing. Question 8. How do you feel about judges who maybe don't run an agility dog but judge? Are there limitations to this, or can you still successfully see lines and set safe courses? So there could be two sides to this. So it could be someone that's maybe got a partner in agility but has never ran an agility dog or competed, or it could be someone that's just not competed for a long time. What would you... You can answer both sides of it if that's easy.
Yeah, so it's good to... consider the context behind that as well, which you've acknowledged there, which is good, because I feel as though my overarching view is that in order to be let's talk about someone who's not a judge yet, and let's say they compete. So if someone is competing in agility and wants to become a judge, then great, but I feel, and this applies to those that aren't competing as well or aren't running with a dog, I feel as though there should be certain requirements before you should be able to become a judge. I do feel as though you need to have had some proof of being of running a dog. I think not because we expect you to be or have any idea just from running a dog how to design a course, but I think it gives you a lot more of just acknowledgement and experience in actually running a course and handling a dog. Because when you're handling a dog, you're always going to be training that dog, and you're going to be aware of that dog's limitations and how it moves, even if at a very basic level. So for me, I think if you aren't a judge at the moment, I feel as though there should be requirements before you can become a judge. So I do feel as though if you don't compete and you are just coming along, or you know, you're just supporting your husband or wife or partner, then I don't feel that it's necessarily appropriate that these people are judging or taking the test without having proved that they are able to run. Now, that doesn't mean to say that they can't just pick up. I'm not saying that absolutely not. They have to buy their own dog and train up to a certain level. I feel like there should be, and God, you could talk about this all day, but I feel there should be some minimum standards for whether they've competed for a certain period of time with that dog, whether they've achieved a certain number of results, because that does show understanding. And also it will at least start begin to get people to understand that, because some people only ever run like small dogs.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think you have a requirement. Is it a requirement? No, I think for championship level, I know you have to have a requirement of judging all heights and grades. But, you know, even having ran a small dog will give you some idea about how a dog moves.
Mm. Definitely.
Obviously very differently to how a large dog moves, but it's still, it gives you some understanding, and obviously gives you that perspective of judging maybe 100 of those dogs as opposed to just seeing the 3 or 4 dogs that you might see at your training venue.
Yeah.
I think it's not, there could be somebody out there sitting there who's a fantastic course designer who doesn't compete. But typically those people are involved in agility through other means, or there's the next point of not being competing for a long time, but have an awareness and keep their nose in. So I'm one of those people. So when my dog Chester retired, I wasn't competing for 6 years. So I didn't actually have a competing dog. I ran people's dogs on and off.
Mm-hmm.
But I kept my nose in judging and course design, and it became a passion of mine. So I took some real interest in learning and development.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore I was able then to progress my understanding and keep judging. So I don't feel as though it should stop you if you originally were running, but if you haven't ran a dog before at all, I do feel as though there should be some more thought given to whether you should be able to become a judge.
Wow. And yeah, I completely agree there. And I didn't realize it was 6 years that you had out in terms of competing. But as you say, it's important that if you are doing that, to make sure you're still looking at the elements that are coming up in course designing, because in 6 years so much can change, can't it? And if you kind of fall out of agility and then come back to it's so much has progressed and
absolutely
become new, or things have been changed and forgotten about. So yeah, no, definitely, I think
absolutely.
That's a really good message. As I say, if you know, there are people out there that are interested, even just borrowing a friend, or because you know people in agility are very very welcoming normally, and just borrowing dogs to actually see that side to it. I know there's a new rule that they're trying to, I don't know if it's become a rule yet or they're pushing through, but is it one so that you can have a white dog that isn't your own that can run over your courses before? And
I believe it was spoken about. I can't remember whether what happened with it really. I don't know whether I think it was spoken about at the last meeting maybe, but I don't know the outcome of it yet. I think they have like white dogs in other countries.
Yes, if you don't know.
Yeah, mainly in like bigger competitions really. And actually a competition I judged in the US in December, and then the one in Germany the weekend after, both had white dogs, and it did help. But I think its application in the UK would be slightly different and problematic.
Yes.
just because I think the one of the reasons why they took they actually allowed that rule, if you didn't know.
The
way the rule was worded, I believe, was that it basically allowed anybody to just run your dog the night before.
Yeah.
So in that case, then it allowed anybody to train their dog. But then even if you look at like on the day of the class,
mm-hmm.
I think if you allow a white dog or two before every single class, you're going to extend the day, and does it end with like training in the ring? And you know,
yeah,
it becomes a bit of a nightmare to manage then, doesn't it?
Yes, definitely. Like I say, it was an interesting concept to read about.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, I think it's good to explore these ideas. Mm. It's just a shame that, you know, it's quite easy for an international competition with like two or three, you know, if it's a final or with two or three rings to apply that sort of that theory, particularly if it's a dog that's not entered in that class. And that's why it's typically just held for finals. Whereas in this country, it would prove a little bit more tricky.
Yeah, which we don't need at this rate.
No, we do not need anything more tricky. No.
Lovely. So question 9, mm-hmm. What's your favourite small sequence or skill to set in your courses? I know most judges, I see a lot of international judges talk about having a specific skill set that you tend to see and a lot of people train for when it comes to the big events. Is there anything that you like particularly?
Yeah, I love a threadle wrap. Like, I love a threadle wrap. I don't know what it is about them. I don't know what it is, but I think obviously when I was like learning about different course design and seeing different sequences and how agility was developing and what was the next sort of big thing. Threadle wraps are not my thing, by the way, but I think I saw a few of them. And then you think, oh, actually, I think because the behavior of the dog and the handler is so different to what you expect. Because it's essentially, it's obviously a testing behavior that's not a threadle. So dogs are used to then having to wrap away from you. So it's a rear cross on a wrap.
Yeah.
But whilst obviously coming past you and wrapping the wing as opposed to the slice. And also it was then, in terms of skill progression, it did allow you to use different parts of or areas of the course that you may well have not used before, or you can throw a jump in somewhere and ask the dogs to flick away from you. So I think threadle wraps have always been like an option. So if you look back at course design, it's not something new, but what happened was people were trying to find more ways of being efficient. And if it typically where someone would do a blind into a push round, rather than get there for the blind push round or not be able to get there, they were like, well, okay. I think let's refer to it. I think look at international course design in general, a lot of and competitions, a lot of people now are choosing to take their dog to the furthest away wing.
Interesting.
To do a slice on a jump as opposed to try and get the dog to collect. Again, not a new theory, but we're seeing more people do that in competition because their dogs are slicing faster on a jump. And it actually happens with threadle wraps as well. So people choose to take the dog to the far wing to slice it as opposed to wrap. Obviously, it's dog dependent.
Yeah.
But it's something that has always been an option, but people haven't really thought about it before or seen it as much of an idea. Or they hadn't schooled their dog in that skill. So all of a sudden these threadle wraps became, not only did it become something that handlers started to do more to give them more flexibility in terms of their movement and being able to get away, but also then from a judge's perspective, it's given us this idea of actually, can we force the handler to do a threadle wrap? Can we, particularly for the higher grades, can we force a threadle wrap that, because of the number of skill sets or sequences or part of the course they need to get to? So it's something that I'm finding quite exciting now because threadle wraps I really like, and regardless of what some people say, I do believe that like my novice dog is trained to do a threadle wrap. So I think people forget that threadle wrap isn't specifically or necessarily a skill that like you have to do. So you can always get there for the blind option. But my novice dog can do a threadle wrap, and therefore it's something I feel as though I can set up in a novice competition.
Yeah.
You know, some people they'll think that's too hard, but as I said, it's not the only option available. I think now we're going to this new phase, but you're particularly for 6-7 dogs where I'm particularly one judge that's really super keen on asking for or offering the dog to see the wrong side of the jump on a threadle wrap. So they have more chance of doing a backside, like a front side front cross. Do you know what I mean? So taking actually the backside of the jump. So they have to lead leg change. So the independence in the skill is not only to take the wing, but also opt to come onto the correct lead leg. And it's not a forced lead leg change, but just the line you offer the dog means the skill is of a greater difficulty level.
Fantastic. And I think, as you say, it's something that, you know, even if you haven't got the skill, it can still be negotiated in other ways. But for those that do teach it, it's a fantastic skill to have because it gives you so much more freedom when it comes to one legs and two getting somewhere else on the course.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Fantastic.
So yeah, I think that for me, for my skill, my favourite small sequence, I like a tunnel under the dog walk with a little bit of a layer.
Yeah.
I think that's probably, without being too specific, what I like to do is some layering. I think that's sort of where agility is going at the moment.
Yes,
More layering and more handler restrictions.
We saw that beast of a layer in the Agility World Championships last year.
We did. Final
agility course. And God, was it interesting to watch.
It was, yeah. And it was actually a super, super cool setup. And I think kudos to Bernd, the Austrian judge, for setting it. Some people are saying maybe it was too hard for the occasion, but it's the World Championship. So, hey ho.
It's going to be hard somewhere. It's got to be there.
Exactly. Yeah. So definitely it's becoming a bit more of a buzzword is layering.
Yes. Fantastic. I hope to see a bit more of it. I think it'll be interesting. It'll add more to the concepts we see currently and less maybe on handler fitness, obviously, and more on actually training skills, which will be interesting.
Exactly.
Fantastic.
Exactly.
So final question. Do you have any last tips for those listening when it comes to course design? Or anything you've thought about that we haven't talked about?
Actually, all these questions are very good because I think we've covered quite a lot.
Yeah, they've been very bad.
I think definitely is use all the space we've already spoken about. Yeah. Use all the space. Don't be afraid to maybe set something that's a bit out of your comfort zone or you're not used to, because you are always going to learn from whatever you set. So you can reflect and think about, you know, whether you'd set it again or do something a bit differently to get a different result. I think one of the biggest things which I'd love to see more of, and it's a tip that I still use every time I judge, is talk to people.
Yeah.
Ask for advice. I have a couple of people that I ask in the UK, but I also have a number of people abroad that I'll just throw a course plan at, and I just want their honest feedback. And I think it's sometimes there's so much to think about in course design, you can sometimes really forget the easy things. And I think, for example, mine is judge's path. So sometimes I set myself some crazy, ridiculous line in order to actually get from one end, you know, one contact to the other, which I don't really mind, but sometimes it's a little bit silly. Just talk to somebody you trust. Doesn't need to be the best judge in the world. Doesn't need to be a judge at all, but somebody that might look at that and go, hold on a minute, what, like, that looks a bit funky, or what about that? And get their advice and feedback and reflect on what you've set and always, there's always something to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So talk to one another, because that's the best way you're going to learn.
And I really like that point, actually, because I only started judging beginning of last year, and it was one of my first initial appointments, and having a chat on the day with actually different judges, there was something on my course design that I wasn't really happy with. It wasn't running for the larger grades. I didn't want to set it because I wasn't 100% on it, and actually from discussing with other judges I was able to amend the course to be more suitable. But and in the end, the part I was really sort of on the edge about, once I'd amended it, was my favorite part of the course
amazing. So
it does show, doesn't it,
absolutely. You know, I think you know, one of the, you know, I mentioned about the running around, looking at trying to find or be in a good position for all the contacts. That's something definitely that I've reviewed or done differently since speaking to my colleagues. I was going to say something else, but I've forgotten it. Damn it, it was there and it's not. I've had personal experiences where people feel like talking isn't is frowned upon, and a negative thing. And I just want to really break down that barrier. And I know that might sound like a boring song. Any final tips? Like, what's your secret? Or what? tell us where you do what you think. But that really is my sort of drive home point. Really, it's that we're all here to help one another. Even myself, I get people message me every day asking for some piece of advice or to look at a course, which I'm more than happy to do. And there's enough people out there that will do that. So, yeah.
I think that's a lovely message to finish on, without a doubt. Problem shared, the problem halved, as they say.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. So just to finish off this podcast, for anyone that's interested, obviously you mentioned earlier about designing courses for others, and I believe you do it internationally, if I'm correct. Where can you find out more information about that?
So I've actually just moved over on Facebook. I have a new Facebook page called Neil Ellis Agility. So it's going to be where I publish all my course designs from all my events. It's going to be where I'm going to be publishing any online potential online future sort of judges courses.
Oh, exciting.
And yes, it's something I would really love to be able to do. So it's something I definitely need to figure out and get it done. But yeah, it's a place to be for finding out more information about my course design service. So yeah, I design courses for international competitions, so for actual trials that they use, their Kennel Club license trials. I do a lot of training courses for people around the world. And so if you're looking for a different type of course design, if you're looking for something, if you're struggling to set something up on your weekly class, if you want a one-off fun competition event, anything, I can design, or at least will be happy to be challenged to design in any sort of space given to me. That's the place to go in and message me to find out. But definitely that's where I'll be hosting or publishing any course, like any training days that I host. Not often I'm hosted by others, so yeah, few and far between, but yeah, that's where it will all be happening.
Amazing. No, that's lovely.
And this is where you can find a link to this podcast.
Oh, thank you. I'll for anyone listening, I'll link it into the notes for the for this podcast episode, so people can find it straight from there. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Neil, for your time and considering all these questions that we got sent in, which, as you said earlier, have been fantastic. Really appreciate wanting to ask those questions. But lovely. Thank you so much.
Sure. No worries. Thanks so much.
You take care.